Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly look at the best in architecture, design, craft and fashion. I'm your host, Nolan Giles. In this week's edition, we bring animal architecture and design for our pets into focus, first heading to Japan House in London to visit an exhibition highlighting how good architecture can create better environments in both our homes and for our beloved pooches. We also hear from Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck about the finest fashion for dogs as he puts some well-made wares to the test at our studio in Midori House. And our Charlie Filmer Court takes us on an audio journey through the history of animal architecture as we learn about the cow barns that have pushed people's creative limits over the years. All that coming up right here on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. Today, we are talking about a subject very close to almost everyone's hearts, animals and pets, all through the lens of good design. Our first stop is at London's Japan House, where the internationally acclaimed Architecture for Dogs exhibition is currently on display. Featuring a number of designs by world-class architects, each exhibit captures the quality of the relationship between humans and their four-legged friends. Japan House London is hosting a special edition of the exhibition, which includes a new edition from London-based architect Asif Khan. Our Maylie Evans checked in with Khan and Japan House London programming director Simon Wright to hear more.
London is really only one part of a larger project. So if you're to come to Architecture for Dogs, you will see the exhibition part of the project. But it also means that you'll be able to take part yourself in creating your own architecture for dogs, which is then uploaded and can be seen online all over the world. My name is Simon Wright. I am Director of Programming at Japan House London.
This is, I believe, the eighth iteration of the exhibition. It's been to China, Japan, Brazil. This is the first time it's being seen in Europe. Why now? What kind of felt like the right time to bring this to London?
This exhibition was always in our minds for doing something like this at Japan House. However, of course, our exhibition schedule has been shattered and we had to try and think of ways to re-engage after lockdown, because this is an exhibition devised by Hara Kenya. Hara-san is, of course, our chief creative advisor for Japan House London. He knows the space already, and it's a way of being able to create something virtually. We haven't had any visitors from Japan. That's not been possible. We've done it completely through the computer screen from the very beginning right through to the installation and the light setting and the positioning.
So the blueprints for the designs are available online. Tell me a bit more about why that aspect of this exhibition is key, and so it isn't just something that you come and see and that's the end of your experience. It continues and you can bring some of this back home with you.
If you're brave enough to take on some of these designs, you can actually make them yourself using blueprints. That's true. An element of the exhibition is for the designs to be in some way capable of being made at home. Some of them are more complicated than others. But it's an aspect of all of them, one hopes, if you look around. The other thing that we've done with these this time here in London is we've recreated five of the designs, and they will be taken outside of Japan House as well, so that dogs and owners can interact with these pieces themselves in the open air, in a safe environment, in order to be able to bring these pieces to life rather than just seeing the pieces inside as art pieces, say, on a plinth.
This exhibition will have dogs coming in as welcome guests. I mean, it should be maybe noted that it's small dogs that can be carried and are well behaved, but they will be making an appearance. I mean, how are you feeling about letting them loose in the gallery?
I'm nervous of dogs being allowed in here. It's an exception. It's something that we would like to happen, of course, because it is architecture for dogs. But of course, they are at the same time art pieces as part of an exhibition which travels the world. We have to make sure that we protect the pieces as well. So any over eager dogs are asked to be well behaved. please.
Looking around, we've got some amazing pieces here. Which for you just brings a smile to your face? Which intrigue you?
What I found interesting are the anecdotes that surround the photo shoots that you have for each of the pieces. So, of course, the exhibition is also online. You can see a little video. There are some nice photos. There are the blueprints to download. And each one had a photo shoot. The stories that come from those photo shoots, how the dogs behaved with the pieces, how some really liked the pieces, how some found it a little bit more difficult to get on with them. I was lucky enough to be in the photo shoot for Asif's piece. When the official photo shooting was over, the dog would return to the piece and nestle in the curve of it and feel very much at home. And it was evident that the piece was suitable for the dog. That's the win for the design, is it not? The client is the dog as well as Harasan. And so if the dog's happy, then that's a good thing. So maybe maybe Asif's piece.
The piece is halfway between a carpet and a low table, sort of two pieces of furniture, which really commonplace in everyone's homes. And when I say it's halfway between these two bits of furniture, it's sort of as though they've melted into each other. My name is Asif Khan, and I'm one of the participants in the Architecture for Dogs exhibition.
And we're sat just next to your piece here, entitled I See You. The listeners, paint them a picture of what they would see.
So the carpet skirt, let's say, is about 2 meters in diameter. And like a mountain, it kind of raises up to a summit, which is about knee height. And what we see on top of it is a little crater with a tiny dog sitting in it. It's not a real dog, it's a mannequin. And the idea of the piece is really about playing games with camouflage, and how an animal can kind of find a new way of existing in the home environment. It looks a bit reminiscent of a couple of other bits of furniture. One famous one from Japan is called a kotatsu. And kotatsu is like a halfway between a table and a carpet, actually. And it's what you stick your legs under to keep your feet warm in the cold, you know, Japanese winter, because they don't have central heating in the traditional houses. But it's also similar to an Iranian kind of piece of home furniture called kursi. It's also something that's seen in Afghanistan, it's seen in Spain. We kind of discovered those relationships afterwards, but it's maybe there are only a series of set types of furniture that are possible, and all other furniture just blends between those.
I understand that a dog's sense of smell might have something to do with the texture. We've got a felted sheep's wool material here.
A little bit of the thinking began on a walk a few months ago with a friend who had a small dog that just disappeared for 20 minutes while we were walking. And we discovered the dog in a tree stump. And it had found its way in and discovered a world inside. And the kind of that as an archetype, you know, you say like a play and discovery for the dog, the mystery of this thing is very much like the prototype for this. So that was the first observation. It's like, wow, dogs want to discover things with their nose and get into things. So the nose begins on the ground here near this carpet. It picks up the smell, and as it sort of learnt about that, it begins to raise its head and discover more about the world around it, right? So they begin on the floor, and then this arc of discovery goes upwards. So the shape of the piece is kind of following the dog's nose from the ground to a vertical surface. We've done a number of projects in the past which deal with like trying to change people's perception or dealing with their sense of space or sight. So we've tried to explore the same sort of territory here. We've made this entirely black curved surface for the dog to kind of explore. It needed to be entirely seamless. So we tried to find a material that was easy to make and put together, but was able to provide this soft, seamless textured surface. And the best candidate was probably the oldest textile known to human beings, which is felt. The piece is made from sheep's wool, which has been felted by my studio. We've kind of worked at it for a few weeks, and we've kind of adapted through watching enormous amounts of YouTube videos of Kazakh and Kyrgyz and Mongolian felt carpet makers, adapted that sort of with sort of a hybrid of hat making, and tried to achieve this kind of quality of hat making, but at the scale of the carpet and the same seamlessness.
a lot of your work is obviously in the built environment, and the scale is with humans. There is a standardisation of this is, you know, what height doors or whatever you need to be. Working on a project like this where that scale is completely shifted and you're not building for humans, you're building for dogs, thinking about the world through their eyes. What has been your approach?
If you design for a different species, all of that stuff goes out of the window. You have to rescale and you have to rethink not just the physical attributes, but also the kind of behavioral attributes, like the ability to jump or to bound over something or to climb or to scratch, to disappear even. I think what Kenyahara wanted to do is to challenge all of us architects, scramble our initial reactions. If you apply your design process, but you change the scale, change the client, maybe you'll get to a way of like refreshing your architecture and kind of rediscovering what the kind of core things are about. The topic of architecture is something that's quite inaccessible to people. A lot of people don't even know what architecture means, like the word. The archaeology, do you mean? This is a project which is, I think, about giving the public a way into architecture because they know dogs so well. And a doghouse or a kennel is really clear to people. Everyone knows Snoopy. When they see that the different response that architects have had to the same challenge, what kind of architecture would you make for a dog? They understand what an architect does and the way an architect thinks and what's different between an architect and maybe an engineer. The project is to give people an introduction to the special value of architecture and how that fits amongst the other arts.
Our thanks to Asif Khan and Simon Wright there, talking to Monocle's Maylee Evans. Monocle's HQ in London is not only a place where we produce our magazines, books, and radio shows. It's also a building that is filled with dog lovers and quite often a few dogs too. One man who could take credit for helping to build a culture where dogs are most welcome and well tended to by Monocle staffers is our editor, Andrew Tuck, whose fox terrier, Macy, is a regular visitor to Midori House. I'm very pleased to say we've been able to have Andrew Tuck join Monocle's Nick Moniz in the studio this week to put the latest in pet attire, toys and accessories to the test as we take a deep dive into the world of design for dogs.
Well, Andrew, thank you for joining us. Normally, you're in the studio for The Urbanist, which you host, but today you're here on Design to unpack another topic very close to your heart, dog accessories. Maybe not dog accessories close to your heart, but Macy certainly is. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
I have a fox terrier called Macy, who's 7 years old. I was slightly underestimate her age like my own, but I believe she's 7 years old. She's a character and she's quite discerning about what she likes. So it's going to be interesting talking about design. And just my tiny thing before we start is often it looks like an amazing design object for the owner is of little interest to the dog. Dogs, they like things that intrigue them a little bit, that have some entertainment value. So she has tons of toys. But sometimes it's slightly disheartening that it's the cheapest, oddest little thing in the basket that she chooses every single time, rather than the thing you've kind of lavished money and time and effort finding. She's very funny. She can search through all the toys. She will pick something different each time. But there are certainly some things which come out. There is just literally a piece of rope that came off another toy, which is kind of her favourite thing. And it's just a piece of rope. So there you go.
But I mean, I think that's probably points to what we're going to look at. We've picked some products from some brands that we really like and we think are nice, but do they actually work? So I've sort of got two goodie bags here that we're going to dive into and I'm going to bring them out. You've had a little bit of a glimpse, but we do want to get your take on it. I feel it's appropriate to start with perhaps leaving the house with Macy. We've got a beautiful elk leather lead here from Hunter, and I just want to get your thoughts on that. What we liked about it was the multiple lengths on it, so you can adjust it so it can be over your shoulder or you can have it wrapped around your wrist. I think the over the shoulder is for dogs that are quite aggressive and pull a lot. Is that something that you would use for Macy perhaps?
Certainly not for Macy, but previous to Macy, we've certainly kind of jumped around with the breeds of dogs that we've had over the years. We had a Weimaraner, so a huge hunting style dog. They're great dogs, but they are very, very difficult to get to walk to heel. So I think for the first 9 years of Bruno's life, I was dragged along the streets. And I tried everything. I tried like harnesses. I tried things that went over their nose, like a kind of muzzle thing you clipped at the back, which I never really liked being on him because people then thought the dog was aggressive and it gave the wrong signals. So something like this is great because you do literally feel with some dogs your arm being tugged from its socket. Now, I'm sure that some people say, oh, it's easy to train a Weimaraner. Let me just say that 9 out of 10 owners of Weimaraners I've seen either have like dislocated shoulders at some point in their ownership of them because they're just a tough dog who wants to be off lead. So I think this is beautiful. And there is something nice about having a great lead that kind of wears with age and things. So leather is a good material for it as well.
I guess to complement the lead, we've got a doggy doo-doo bag holder. I don't know, doo-doo felt juvenile, but I felt scared to say poop on air. This is from British brand Mutts and Hounds. It's almost like a luggage tag with a little slit in it that you can slide dog poop bags in. Just from your description of Bruno, would that have held a bag big enough for him?
Let's be blunt. No.
This has deteriorated very quickly. I mean, it's a beautiful little item. Is that something that you could see using perhaps for Macy?
I could. Yeah, I'm sure that there are many well-organized people who would use this. And it's shaped like the British 50 pence piece. You can pop maybe like one or two tiny bags in it. You need a pretty small bag. I've kind of gone for the other look, which is I don't think there's a jacket that I can put on that doesn't either have a dog poo bag in one pocket and like some dried biscuits in the other. I'm endlessly forgetting to take them out. When you go to check your luggage and things, you find them in your bags. Many a time I've kind of gone halfway around the world, gone to put a jacket on to go out for dinner and realise I have Macy's treats in my pocket. So it's nice and cute. I'm less organised than this, I'm afraid. It's big country style jackets for the weekend, stuffed with bags, treats and God knows what.
And maybe this is more about helping you, I guess, have fewer dog treats and dog bags in your pockets. But we've got this backpack from the Canadian brand Wagwear, which I think is absolutely gorgeous. Personally, I might even wear it myself. We had the other researcher, Charlie, who works on this show, try it on it and wear it around. But it's essentially a gorgeous backpack to be strapped onto your dog. It's about the size of your hand if you spread out your fingers. Decently sized enough to carry more than a few dog treats and maybe even a ball as well, or its lead once it's coiled up. Could you see Macy wearing this?
There is no way that she would go anywhere wearing that. Now, there are dogs, I've seen these dogs, and I'm not sure what their temperament is, who trot around all dressed up, wearing lots of clothing. It's interesting when you're in Japan, for example, where the age at which people get married is incredibly late. And in fact, many people no longer get married. They leave single lives, don't have kids. And there is a displacement thing, you know, that you do lavish your love, attention and any money on your dogs. And you kind of dress them up and you put them in, well, not me, but some people you even see putting them in prams and things. I don't think it's great for a dog. Let's remember, a dog is already wearing a fur coat, wants to run when it goes to the park. It wants to kind of feel free. And whenever I put these kinds of things on her, she kind of stands frozen, just kind of looking at you saying, please take this off. So cute. I'm sure there are dogs that like it. This is a good example of something that's probably more amusing for the owner and less amusing for the actual hound that's wearing it, in my opinion.
I guess continuing in that vein, but perhaps something that's, I think, a little bit more practical, or certainly a lot more practical, is a great Wellington boot by Wagwear as well. You sort of referenced it there, and with different cultures dressing up their animals. But I mean, I think in some climates, this sort of boot certainly is essential. Maybe not for London, but could you see Macy wearing these? This is a sort of like a green boot.
They look like little tear droplets of green rubber, and you have a little piece of Velcro around them. You can slide your dog's paw in and kind of strap it on. Again, I would struggle to get these on Macy and get her moving. And again, in a temperate climate, or in a climate like the UK's, where even at the weekends when we go out now, it's mud that we're contending with. Her feet don't get cold. Now, if you go out in snow for a long time, I think she could get cold feet. But I think she would let you know, and we just wouldn't go out and stick her in on an ice rink or anything. But if you are in a climate where maybe it's incredibly cold, you do have to be careful, and vice versa. In incredibly hot places, you do hear about dogs singeing their pads on very hot tarmac as well. Although I wouldn't put a Wellington boot on for that. Maybe there's a sandal version for the summer.
Now, I guess to sort of wrap this up, we want to look at the actual dog toys. And I know earlier you mentioned that Macy was perhaps a little bit obsessed with a piece of rope. I'm curious what she would, again, make of this toy. This is from Mungo and Maud, a British brand. Would that compete for her attention?
I have to kind of be honest here that I'm a sucker for Mungo and Maud. They have a very nice shop, and she has various things from Mungo and Maud. Everything they make is absolutely beautiful. So this is kind of two knotted heads of rope at each end and a plait in between. But this is a chunky one. It's like the size of a big bone. What dogs like about these things is there's the sensation of crunching your teeth into something that's safe, and it's good then for dislodging plaque and things from your dog's teeth. There's something about rope that is just very enjoyable. So this is the kind of thing that she would like. And the other thing about our dog, and I think many dogs, is that notion of something you can tug and you can pull. So it's really good because you can grab hold of one end and she can pull the other. And that can keep most dogs entertained for a very long time.
I guess the last item. Now, I saw a few of these. The British brand Barber, who's very famous and well-respected for their outerwear, have a similar sort of duck toy. This one's from Sophie Allport, who's a British homewares designer. Again, talking about the Barber one as well, I think that one's worth noting. That had sort of like a tough tartan finish. This one here is a bit more canvas-like, this pheasant toy here. Is this something that is more about the novelty of having a hunting dog with a killer in instinct that they might want to play with, or is this something that Macy again, or perhaps even Bruno you're talking about earlier, would have been interested in?
So this is a cock pheasant. It's a British bird, and its legs are again a knotted piece of rope. So this is quite a good kind of grab hold and chew. She would be more entertained if this had a squeak in it to begin with. There is a squeak in here.
Have a go.
Well, I can't.
You've got to find it.
Oh, ha, ha, ha. See, that is good because oddly, when the dog finds that, then it becomes slightly obsessed, which is. At Christmas, when people give you one of these, it's like, oh, so sweet. And then after an hour, you're like, please stop. And you have to kind of hide it. But anyway, this would be good for her. She would love the squeak. They're very good at destroying the squeaks. But while it lasted, I think it's a rather nice thing.
So Macy's happy. You're perhaps going a little bit insane.
You go a little bit mad. But it's like the equivalent of like when your family give your child a drum kit for Christmas. It's like, I don't know if it's a very pheasanty sound. But anyway, this would appeal to her.
My thanks to Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, joining our Nick Manise to talk all things design for dogs. And now our animal theme continues in a special edition of our design news. Let's find out more with Monocle's Maylee Evans.
It's off to Parada in Portugal, where Raulino Silva Arquitecto has unveiled a new cat and dog hotel. Built on an old vineyard, it provides individual spaces for the animals placed around indoor play areas, keeping both the cats and dogs apart, of course, to avoid any trouble. The hotel also includes an on-site vet, grooming parlours, and wouldn't be complete without a pet pool. If you are already starting to plan your next summer holiday, then it's probably only fair that you do the same for your furry friends too. To Paris now, where the cat belonging to the late fashion designer Karl Lagerfeld has collaborated with German animal furniture design company Lucy Balu. The famed feline called Choupette is endorsing their latest hammock-style bed called Swing, which is made of felted wool and is attached neatly to the wall by powder-coated mounts. Their product is on a limited run of 1,000 pieces, so hurry if you want a stylish and rather cosy perch for your cat. And now finally to Austria, where Viennese artist Barbara Ann Huser's floating sculpture Flying Udder took to the skies above the city. Under the honorary protection of Austria's First Lady and to mark the country's National Day public holiday, the balloon rose 262 metres into the air above the 13th District and floated above the capital before landing in the nearby Lerbau National Park. The sculpture is, as you might have guessed, a floating cowadder strapped to a hot air balloon basket, which made the event a striking visual comment on humanity's reliance on animals. We can expect more flights similar to this in the coming years and months, so here's hoping the udder will make an appearance above a city near you. Back to you, Nolan.
Thanks, Maylee. If that's not enough news, then subscribe to our On Design newsletter, which hits inboxes every Wednesday. And finally, humans have long been fascinated with home building for their furry friends. From old European pig palaces to London Zoo's modernist 1930s Lubetkin penguin pool. Yet often, the animals' needs aren't properly addressed in design. As an example, the poor penguins suffer from achy joints due to their habitat's impractical design. Creating a design compromise between an animal's well-being and the architectural merit of buildings that house them is a fine art. Often in the world of farming, this can be forgotten altogether, and animals can lose out on the quality of life that they deserve. The world's best animal architects have grappled with these issues, and in doing so created a whole new typology for designing around them. Now, taking the bull by the horns, Monocle's Charlie Filmacourt takes us through the history of animal architecture and the learnings that designers have absorbed over the years.
Who are the best animal designers? Is it the bee with its precise hive? The beaver in its impressively engineered dam? Or birds with their wabi-sabi nests? Structural engineers and qualified designers will attest that the work of these animal architects is, quite frankly, astounding. But what of the animals that rely on us for their shelter? Dogs looking for kennels or cows in need of a barn? Their requirements present a unique design brief for architects. Engineering and design involved in their constructions has long focused on efficiency rather than aesthetics, leaving ugly constructions in typically lovely rural parkland and outdoor settings. Take, for instance, our first attempts at architecture for animals. Much of it had more to do with practicality rather than the well-being of the animals and beautiful designs for our eyes. Shepherds in past times would provide basic structures that put a roof over their flock's head. Not for any altruistic means, but more so they could sleep next to the animals to benefit from their heat. And where they were of architectural interest, they may not have been built with a precise understanding of the animal's needs. In recent years, however, we've seen our understanding of the needs of our furry, scaled, and feathered friends evolve. Many architects are now looking for design compromises that ensure an animal's well-being and a farm's efficiency, all whilst giving structures architectural merit. To do so, designers are shifting their anthropomorphic views of architecture for animals and escaping the confines of human-centric design to ensure that buildings can have tangible benefits for animals. Take, for instance, the transparently cladded cowshed in Ligne, Switzerland, by local architecture. It does away with traditional opaque walls, giving the cows an enviously splendid view of the rolling green surroundings. The building evolution that probably illustrates best, though, just how far animal architecture has come is the pioneering work that has happened with the humble chicken coop. These small, often simple, often wire-based structures have actually become an area of interest of late for architects such as Kengo Kuma and Architecture Research Office, both of whom have worked on contemporary, wood-based solutions to house our feathered friends in a better way. It's not just in farming either where animal architecture is being upgraded. There's Foster and Partners elephant enclosure at Copenhagen Zoo that features two glass-domed enclosures, allowing bull elephants to get away from the rest of the herd when they need to be alone. And also, Atelier About Architecture's house, tailored to suit an injured dog, is designed with soft flooring to be gentle on the animal's joints and also has ramps and stairs coated with waterproof non-slip coating to ensure comfortable movement. There's also been numerous recent efforts to develop bird-proof glass too. These are all prime examples of just how architects can make a difference. As our love of animals shows no sign of waning, and the awareness of animal welfare continues to increase, the chances are that we will see ever more prominent architects turn their hand at building innovative architectural solutions with animals in mind, and for many years to come. Here's to hoping that architects will continue making creature comforts a priority.
My thanks to Monocle's Charlie Filmacourt there for that report. And sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show. Listen to our 5-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra, if you're keen for more. This airs every Thursday. Today's show was produced and edited by Maylie Evans, thanks to our researchers Nick Manise and Charlie Filmacourt. I'm Nolan Giles. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.